Well, we've been hearing a lot about Dan Brown. Of course, we've been hearing a lot about Dan Brown for about 2 years now. The novel's been a roaring success. 60 million copies sold worldwide. It's gone from hardback to paperback. And the film opened this last weekend on Friday. Now, you know, the critics were not that happy with the film. I've talked to several people who've seen it. I have not yet seen it. They say long. They say if you didn't read the book, you're going to have a hard time with the last half hour of the movie because you might be lost. Other than that, the first 2 hours it was pretty interesting, pretty interesting. I'm waiting to see it myself, see how the Da Vinci Code movie comes out. We've heard a lot about the Da Vinci Code and a lot about Dan Brown. Here in the first hour of Issues Etc. today, we're going to hear from Dan Brown, a speech that he gave up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, very recently, right before the movie came out, talking about his book, talking about the movie, talking about his worldview. And he speaks at least with some sense of authority on a number of subjects here. We're going to be playing the audio here, playing it stop and start for your reaction. It's audio open lines in the first hour of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin, and thanks for tuning us in. Then starting at 4:15, we'll talk about Christianity in Sweden and Finland. A very interesting story. Several months ago, one of our good friends, Bishop Obari of Kenya, was in Sweden. What was he doing? He was ordaining a bishop who in turn ordained some pastors. Why was he doing that? Because in the Church of Sweden, the Lutheran Church of Sweden, you can't be ordained if you hold to the Lutheran confessions and refuse to cooperate with the ordained female clergy in that church. The young men who won't aren't ordained, and there are churches there who need these confessional Lutheran pastors. We'll be talking with the pastor Bent Bergerson, about 4:15, he'll be joined also with Pastor Eric Andre, a regular guest here on the program. Pastor Bergerson is General Secretary of the Mission Province in Sweden and Finland. Then, in the 5 o'clock hour of Issues Etc. today, Pastor Jeffrey Kloa will be in the studio with us as well. He's Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Picking up on the whole questions raised by the Da Vinci Code, we'll talk about how we got the New Testament from 5 to 6 here on Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, it is back and working, issuesetc@kfuo.org. By the way, thanks to Pastor John Temple, to the good folks at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue for hosting our live remote broadcast there Thursday last week. It was a pleasure to be out there. Very nice to meet some of our listeners. And who was with us? Oh, that roundtable of pastors, they did a great job on the Lord's Supper. And Pastor Dr. Lewis Brighton was with us to talk about Judgment Day. Thanks to everybody who helped out with that live remote broadcast at Village Lutheran Church last Thursday on Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers again, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It was late in April that Dan Brown was speaking, a very rare public appearance for Dan Brown. You've seen him in the news, but it's been more related to the lawsuits that he's been fending off in London, which he won, by the way. But he does not speak that often in public. It was late in April. He was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. New Hampshire is his home state. And he was talking to a group of radio listeners. The audio comes from New Hampshire Public Radio. Now, as you listen to Dan Brown during this hour of audio open lines, wax eloquent on theology and science, and history, and art. Keep in mind that before writing the novels for which he is now famous, The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons before that, Dan Brown was a high school English teacher. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a high school English teacher, but does it qualify someone to speak authoritatively on how religions relate to one another, what religions really are all about? He speaks like an expert on Christian history, which kind of runs him afoul in two disciplines. One, the Christian part and the history part. He was an English school teacher, high school English teacher, and has a double major from Amherst College in Spanish and English. Now, that does qualify him, I think, and after having written two very big novels, to talk about the writing process, to talk about writing a novel, to talk about writing fiction. But he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about that. He has no advanced degree in theology and philosophy, or in history, or in art, for that matter, because that seems to be another thing he will speak eloquently about. So as you listen, remember that you're listening to a former high school English teacher. Now, I had a high school English teacher. It didn't happen to be a man. It was a woman. And in the classroom, she usually stuck to English. Literature, poetry, prose, all of those things that you learn in English. My daughter has a junior high English teacher. As far as I know, she does not claim to be an expert in Christian history, philosophy, or in the evolution of religious thought. Dan Brown? Well, listen for yourself. He does. Here he is speaking on the 23rd of April in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
My agent likes to joke that the only way to get me to appear in public these days is to sue me for plagiarism. It's been quite a year of lawsuits. By the way, if anybody in the audience would like to sue me, we have forms out back that you can just pick up on your way out. Seriously, though, a far better way to persuade me to appear in public is to give me a chance to speak at a benefit for the Portsmouth Music Hall, a great old theater that brings big-time entertainment to a small New England town, and we're very grateful to have them here. So thank you. Laura Kanoy and New Hampshire Public Radio are here tonight. I'm a big fan of their programming, in particular their accurate news reporting. Yes. Now, I should tell you, when you're in the news a lot, you start to realize just how little the news actually has to do with reality. I got back from this trial in London to a story that my wife had actually written the novel Da Vinci Code while I was out playing tennis. I also heard that we were building a 10-foot-high fence around our entire property, complete with a Renaissance moat. It's all wrong, of course. If we had a moat, it would be medieval. Anyhow, I'm happy to be here, and thank you for coming. I have a lot to talk about tonight, and I want to leave time for your questions. But everybody just seems to be busting at the seams to want to hear about the movie. And so I thought I would start by answering the one question that everybody asks me these days. Dan, do you like the movie? There is an old saying in publishing, the best an author can hope for from Hollywood is the opportunity to be disappointed. I'm happy to say that whoever said that is dead wrong. The movie version of The Da Vinci Code is mesmerizing. This movie reminds me of why I loved movies as a kid. When movies felt exciting and fresh, when they revealed new ideas and took me to places I'd never seen before, when they challenged me, when they scared me, when they opened my mind, and when I came out of the theater feeling like I'd been on a long journey. I really believe that people are going to come out of the theater feeling this kind of experience. They'll also feel like they've just watched the novel, which is terrific. I am biased. That's true. But I'm biased in the wrong direction. Novelists are always their movie's harshest critic. Novelists hate to be adapted and edited, and we really expect every single word of dialogue that we wrote to appear on the screen. Never mind that movies would be 20 to 30 hours long if they did that. Adaptation is a difficult process, especially for a novel as long and complicated as The Da Vinci Code. But this script is powerful and thought-provoking, the locations are stunning, and the cast is world-class. My wife and I were fortunate to spend a lot of the summer in Europe on set, and at times it was like standing in the pages of the book. I will never forget wandering at 2 o'clock in the morning through the Grand Gallery of the Louvre, sort of secretly drifting away from the film crew and exploring the deserted corridors with a flashlight. And we had the entire Denon wing to ourselves. It was just deserted. At one point, I found myself standing all alone in front of the Mona Lisa. Of course, as if that weren't strange enough, if you look sort of back out to the Grand Gallery, every now and then you see a 70-year-old curator running by, terrified with a pale monk in pursuit. So, it was a pretty surreal experience. Kind of like walking through a three-dimensional version of your own imagination.
Now, look, Dan Brown's on top of the world right now, and I don't begrudge him any of his success or the fame and the notoriety that he's gained for himself. He spent a lot of hard work writing that novel. It's not easy to write a novel, and it's not easy to write a successful novel. So we won't begrudge him his success. But he's on top of the world right now. But remember, folks, high school English teacher. Now, at this point, he's just talked about the film, and he has a right to his own opinions on whether he thinks the film is mesmerizing or not. The several I've talked to who've seen the film said it is mesmerizing in a way. That is, just last night we talked with Brent McGuire, who said now he did get a sense of the eternal watching the Da Vinci Code film because it seemed like it lasted that long. And is it true he actually had to wake up his wife when it was over? Really? Okay, now I haven't seen it, so it may be mesmerizing. It may be a real spine tingler. It may not. So he's entitled to his opinion about the film that is based upon his book, about his opinions about the Mona Lisa or anything else, right? But remember, he's starting out in a lighthearted way. He's going to move on to some more heady subjects on which he will speak with equal authority. High school English teacher. Keep those three words in mind as we listen to Dan Brown.
And during that first night on the set, watching some of the world's finest actors and filmmakers bringing this book to life, I had a pretty good idea that the entire experience would be a magical one. It's funny, the screenwriter, Akiva Goldsman, who's become a dear friend, came up to me that first night and he said, "Dan, you do know you're now spoiled forever, right?" And I sort of said, "Akiva, what are you talking about?" He said, "This is your first day on a movie set, and you're standing in the Louvre's Grand Gallery next to Ron Howard watching Tom Hanks play your hero. Just so you know, it doesn't always happen like that. Apparently in the movie business, your first day on set generally involves some low-budget soundstage where you watch a B-actress screaming in horror as she's consumed by giant snails from outer space. So I feel pretty lucky to have missed that particular step. Participating in the making of this movie was a wonderful experience, and I couldn't be happier with the way it all turned out. Of course, the movie will have its vocal critics, as does the novel. You may have read that the filmmakers were pressured to tone down the more controversial themes in the movie. But to their credit, they set out with one goal from the beginning, to make the book, and to stay as true as possible to the themes in the novel. Ron Howard commented in this week's Time magazine, "With material as controversial as this, if you try to soften the edges, you're kidding yourself. Either you're dealing with these ideas or you're not." The funny thing is that now the filmmakers will start having the same kind of awkward experiences that I've been having for the last 3 years. Recently, I met a priest at a book event, and this man came up to me, warmly shook my hand, and said, "Mr. Brown, I don't like your novel one bit." I was kind of taken aback. And then this man smiled and said, "But I just had to come over here and thank you." He went on to say, "Every Wednesday night for the past 10 years, I've held Bible study in my office. And every Wednesday night, I've had the same 8 people show up. Last month, I put in the usual notice in the church bulletin reminding people of Wednesday Bible study and noting that this week's topic was the Da Vinci Code." And this guy paused for effect before he smiled very excitedly and said, "I had 217 people." He was thrilled. And he said, "I've been trying to get people interested in this stuff for years, and I have to admit, talking about a novel wasn't quite how I pictured it, but I'm not complaining." In the next month, with the movie coming out, many churches are enthusiastically poised to take advantage of the surge of interest in our religious history. They are embracing the controversy.
Now, that's true.
Nuns.
Hey, stop it, Dan. I want to say something. We'll let you continue in just a minute. Hold your horses. You might sell 60 million, but I still control the microphone here. It is true that many churches are embracing the controversy, not so much the controversy, but trying to respond to the controversy, to the so-called truths raised by Dan Brown in his novel and the film. And in that sense, yeah, they're embracing the controversy, not the falsehoods. You know, I was driving past a UCC church the other day, and there was a sign outside that said, "The truth about the Da Vinci Code." And now, this is a notoriously, the UCC, the United Church of Christ as a church body, is notoriously liberal. They're the ones who have the transgendered choir singing at their General Assembly, that are dressed in the clothes opposite of their gender, and then during the course of singing some gospel song, they strip off those clothes and reveal their, well, is it a true gender? I don't know. It's all very confusing. But in any event, this congregation, a member of the UCC, is among the more liberal local congregations of that church body. And I saw the sign outside that said the truth about the Da Vinci Code, and I wish there had been a stop sign so I could just stop there and think about it. There wasn't. But the first thought that ran through my mind is, what will they be saying? I mean, this is a church body that says that God is still speaking, that God is leading the church into new truths and new directions, contrary to the old truths and the old directions. And I wonder what they consider the truth of the Da Vinci Code. Now, most churches, and here we got to talk about the Roman Catholic Church, most churches, and that really is most churches, responding to the Da Vinci Code, have been trying to clarify and to correct the inaccuracies in the novel. We were talking last night with Dr. Paul Meyer, who said, well, you know, when he first started responding to the Da Vinci Code, he's a professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. When he first started responding to the Da Vinci Code, he kind of was careful, handled it with kid gloves, said, you know, there are inaccuracies, some things that need to be corrected. And he came right out of the box last night on our national program saying it's lies. There's no other way to talk about it but lies. Dan Brown is telling lies. And he really took after the publishers for, even after being corrected in the public press about things like the Priory of Zion, its origins, its true origins, the publishers are still letting the novel stand with absolutely no correction. They don't have to change the novel. They just could put a little blurb at the beginning of the paperback version of the Da Vinci Code saying, by the way, Dan Brown has the Priory Sion wrong. But enjoy the book anyway. They didn't. Churches are embracing the controversy. There is an opportunity here. Now, it is true, and I think this should be pointed out, that Dan Brown's novel, like all other novels, will be here today and gone tomorrow. It will be. Probably what? Maybe 2 years from now? Unless there's some big sequel, I don't know how you top what he did. People won't be talking about it. But right here and right now, people do need to talk about it. I'm a little uncomfortable with the fact that it takes something like this to get people to go to Bible class in a church. Really, the Bible is far more interesting, even as literature, than the Da Vinci Code.
I talk to priests, nuns, and clergymen all the time. Some of them love the novel, and some of them don't. But most are energized by the debate that's been sparked. And they're using this debate as a springboard to teach, to engage, and to connect with their congregations. I hear from a lot of people in the church, and quite often from Catholic nuns. Admittedly, some of them say they would like to wrap my fingers with a ruler. But most of them have had the exact opposite reaction to the novel. And for them, the idea of the lost sacred feminine has really struck a nerve. The idea that women have been marginalized by religion. Several nuns have told me that reading this novel gave them the strength to speak out on a forbidden topic, being that nuns pledge their entire lives to the church, figuratively marry themselves to Jesus, dedicate all of their energies to their faith, and yet their church still declares them unfit to be priests.
Now, they now finally feel the liberty to speak out on a quote-unquote forbidden topic. Is there a different Roman Catholic Church, especially here in America, that I haven't been paying attention to? As far as I've heard, some of the most vocal American Catholics have no problem with speaking out on the fact that they think women ought to be ordained as priests. There are whole organizations, whole groups, whole publications in American Roman Catholicism who say with a completely straight face that they think women ought to be ordained as priests. Now, this is evidence of how little Dan Brown may have been paying attention to what's going on in the Roman Catholic Church. That he thinks his novel has suddenly given rise to people who've been these pent-up feelings of suppression all these nuns out there who are saying, oh, for so long, we wished we could talk about this. And now with your novel, thank you so much, Mr. Brown, for bringing up this forbidden topic and giving us permission to voice our views. They were voicing their views a long time ago. What Dan Brown is doing with his novel is tapping into those views. But the ordination of women to the priesthood is hardly a forbidden topic. If it is, American Roman Catholic bishops are doing a terrible job of forbidding it. But he did mention something there you're going to listen to as this goes on. Dan Brown speaking in New Hampshire in late in April. And that is a loss of the sacred feminine. It's the undercurrent of Dan Brown's novel and in the film that there was in Christianity a sacred feminine characterized, typified by Mary Magdalene, that has been lost and suppressed by Christianity for nearly 2,000 years.
Simply because they are women. How can this be? In my mind, there really is no fair answer. You can't simply respond, well, because that's the way the early church worked. By that argument, we should still be burning witches and claiming that the sun revolves around the earth.
Which are things that the church may have claimed or may have done in the past, but in spite of itself and not because that's what the church officially taught. Already, the cracks in his view of history are showing. Now, do you remember the three words I told you to remember? High school English teacher. He can speak expertly on church history already, on the frustration of certain groups in the Roman Catholic Church, finally given license to speak on forbidden topics, the loss of the sacred feminine, high school English teacher. Now, if someone's going to talk about these things, rather than just kind of relay information they may have read in a book, they really, really ought to have some expertise. Where's his expertise? A double major in English and Spanish, high school English teacher, wrote a book, sold 60 million copies worldwide, had it made into a movie that was opening last weekend, and now Dan Brown feels that he can speak on just about any and every topic, and he's not done. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear him talk more about the loss of the sacred feminine, about church history, about theology, where Christianity came from, how all religions really, in spite of what they say about themselves, are really all just addressing the same God, finding different ways to talk about this God. We're listening to Dan Brown's New Hampshire talk here in the first hour of Issues, Etc. It's Audio Open Lines. When we come back, more of Dan Brown.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, Senior Editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
What do you know about Susan B. Anthony? You might be surprised.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony list, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The namesake of the Susan B. Anthony list was an outspoken opponent of abortion, referring to it as child murder. Anthony was a Quaker and outspoken not only against abortion, but against legal prostitution and slavery as well. She did not marry or have children, but said the following regarding her life's work. "Sweeter even than to have had the joy of caring for children of my own, has it been to me to help bring about a better state of things for mothers, so that their unborn little ones could not be willed away from them."
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. If you saw or caught replays of the Preakness, you saw Kentucky Derby winner Barbaro burst out of the gate only to pull up lame. Barbaro sustained multiple fractures in his right hind leg, fractures that may be fatal. Isaiah 31 says, "Woe to those who rely on horses, who trust in the multitude of their chariots and in the great strength of their horsemen, but do not look to the Holy One of Israel." Barbaro reminds us that you can be in the winner's circle one day and fighting for your life the next. Do you value your strength? Physical, financial, or emotional strengths impress us creatures more than they wow God. "His pleasure is not in the strength of the horse, nor his delight in the legs of a man," says Psalm 147. "The Lord delights in those who fear him, who put their hope in his unfailing love." The truth is, we need reminders to keep our priorities in order. Psalm 32 says, "Do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle." Do you remember the TV show Mr. Ed? Mr. Ed was a talking horse who gave advice to his owner, Wilbur. Let Barbaro's experience give you some wisdom as you start out of the gate this new week. I thank you for listening. I thank you for thinking. I'm Dale Meyer.
Lace up your walking shoes and let's get moving. It's time for the 5th annual 50-mile, 3-day Dean Team Automotive MS Challenge Walk. The walk is the weekend of June 2nd through the 4th. Participants will walk a total of 50 miles, winding through various local communities, and spend 2 nights at Ladue High School. The goals for the event are 250 participants and $650,000 in funds raised. Again, the dates for the walk, June 2nd through the 4th.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming up in about 45 minutes. We're going to be starting a conversation on Christianity in Sweden and Finland. Pastor Bent Bergerson is going to join us. He's General Secretary of the Mission Province in Sweden and Finland. And Pastor Eric Andre, Campus Pastor at First Trinity Lutheran Church in Pittsburgh. They'll both be here in Studio A for a brief conversation on that subject. In the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to be spending that with Pastor Jeffrey Kloa, Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. How did we get the New Testament? Dan Brown has his version. His version is that religion is a constantly evolving thing and that the New Testament really was the product of the winners writing the history and the winners deciding what goes in the book. And since Constantine was a Christian, the Christians were winners, then that's how we got the New Testament. Let's do a little correction and clarification of that in the third hour of Issues, Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The phone lines are open for your questions and comments on Dan Brown's talk last month in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. You know, when someone writes a novel, think about Michael Crichton. He writes a novel. The most he opines on is, say, the environment, global warming, something like that. He's a novelist. Most people say, he's a novelist. What does he know about global warming? Okay, I don't want to upset my Michael Crichton fans in the audience. So I'm using him as an example. John Grisham, what does he write? Write what you know. Write what you know is the first rule of writing. He writes about the courtroom because he's a lawyer. Scott Turow, same thing, writes about the courtroom. He's a lawyer. He knows a crime. He knows murder. So he writes about that. You don't see John Grisham or Scott Turow out there talking to groups about religion or anything outside how do you write a good novel, a good mystery, a courtroom novel. Not that I know of. Dan Brown is out there talking about every subject under the sun. Well, that's kind of how the Da Vinci Code works. It encompasses so much, so many subjects. But just because you write an alternate history doesn't mean you're an expert on history. But for the time being, listen up. This is very interesting, his insights into religion. And you will note that he doesn't begin his sentences with, I think, or at least it's my view that, no. Speaking with some authority here on religion in general.
Religion is a work in progress. We learn from its mistakes. We evolve and mature. And exactly that is what keeps religion relevant and exciting. Tonight I want to share with you an outtake from the Da Vinci Code. Not the movie, we don't have a screen, actually the novel, an outtake from the novel. I write a lot of material that never makes it into the novel, and this bit I'm about to read to you is a section that I cut from chapter 74, but I was reminded of it while I was writing the comments for this evening, and I dug it up because I think it illustrates an important point. In this scene, Professor Langdon is speaking to one of his Harvard classes about how we all tend to fear what we don't understand, and about the importance of being open-minded toward religious ritual that is unfamiliar to us. Langdon tells his class that much of the religious intolerance in the world stems from a lack of understanding of rituals, rites, and symbols. The conversation turns to the practice of corporal mortification and self-flagellation. Langdon students are not shy about expressing their distaste for this. And I'm quoting now from the section I cut. The young woman in the front row grimaced. You're kidding. Some people actually whip themselves? My friends, Langdon replied, the idea of forcing ourselves to suffer physically as part of our penance is nothing new. In some traditions, the devout take vows of solitude, during which they sit alone in caves for years at a time. Some wrap chains around their bodies and march for miles carrying effigies of the Virgin Mary. Some take vows of silence and actually remove their tongues. Some of you in this very classroom probably fast on certain religious holidays, denying your body's food. It's all a matter of degree, but it stems from the same desire, to overcome the challenge of being spiritual beings trapped inside physical bodies. All of us, in our own private way, try to free our spirits of the physical realm. And religion offers us myriad rituals to help us do that, from meditation to fasting to the punishment of our own flesh. The young woman looked unconvinced. I still say it's bizarre. Bizarre, Langdon said? That's too bad. If that seems bizarre to you, then I know you'll never want to join my cult. She looked uneasy. You're in a cult? Langdon nodded and lowered his voice to a conspiratorial whisper. Don't tell anyone, but on the pagan day of the sun god, I kneel at the foot of an ancient instrument of torture and consume ritualistic symbols of blood and flesh in the primal tradition of god-eating. The entire class looked horrified. Langdon shrugged, and if any of you care to join me, come to the Harvard Chapel on Sunday, kneel beneath the crucifix, and take Holy Communion.
Now, this is an excerpt that he excerpted from the novel. You wouldn't read that in the novel, you won't see it in the film. So you get a little preview into how this tells us more about Dan Brown than it does about the Da Vinci Code, really. Dan Brown's view of all religions, and he's headed this direction, so listen carefully as he goes on. His view of all religions is they're all basically the same thing. Man is striving to free himself as a spiritual being trapped in a body from the physical. So, you know, some people self-flagellate, some people take vows of poverty or silence. Some people go and kneel in front of a crucifix and take Holy Communion, but it's all the same thing. We're all just trying to do it in a myriad of different ways. So now here's the punchline that he doesn't get to until a little bit later. So who's to judge? Who's right? And who's wrong? I tell you what, if he really wanted it to be controversial, he would have left that passage in. Because not only Roman Catholics, but a fair number of Lutherans, Anglicans, Orthodox would have been deeply offended by his characterization of what the Lord's Supper is. High school English teacher. Just remember those three words as we listen to Dan Brown. Yes, he sold a lot of novels. He's a high school English teacher who sold a lot of novels. Yes, he's got a big movie out, and he's rubbed shoulders with Tom Hanks and the director of the movie, the name Ron Howard.
Opie.
I want to call him Opie every time. Or Richie, but... Sure, yes. And he's a celebrity, and chances are, after the movie comes out, he'll do the round with all the big names, and you'll see him walking the red carpet and all those kind of things. High school English teacher. You know who used to be a high school English teacher, too, if I'm not mistaken? Sting. I love Sting. Sting is cool. He's almost Elvis cool, but not quite. All right? He's almost Bob Dylan cool, but not quite. Great music. Talented musician. Probably one of the most talented musicians ever, I think, in pop music. High school English teacher. What does Sting stick to? He had that time, remember, we were talking about the deforestation down in the Southern Hemisphere. He did some of that, right? And then he went back to playing the bass and making albums. And sure, he's got his causes. And I mean, he's like Bono. He's got his causes. But he's a high school English teacher who joined a very famous 1980s band, made a great solo career for himself, and proved that he's a good musician, too. And he pretty much sticks to what he knows. He doesn't claim to be an expert on much other than the music industry. I imagine he knows a little something about English. He's got some sort of strange sexual practices that he likes to talk about, I guess. But other than that, he doesn't opine on world history or religion because, you know, he's a high school English teacher who knows how to play the bass and has proven that he can make a lot of money doing that and singing. We're listening to Dan Brown's address from last month in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It's audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Darlene's been waiting on the line there in St. Louis. Darlene, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor.
Hi.
I pray that you and the family are doing well.
Yes, we are. Thank you.
Although I sound like awful, it's just allergies, so don't anybody be all upset. I'm confused, Pastor. Okay, all of our lives we've been taught that, not verbally, I have never in all of my umpteen years, and if you really must know, I could tell you there are a few, that Jesus was ever single. We assumed, and we know what that word means, that he was. Now this comes out, and it puts a thought in my mind, whether he was or whether he wasn't. It's not the issue. But why wouldn't he have been? I'm thinking, if he is human like I am, like you are, that in a normal heterosexual situation is what we would do. So why would it be an issue if he was or was not married to Mary Magdalene?
Well, it's a good question, Darlene, and the best answer I've heard was given last night on our Sunday night national edition of Issues, Etc. by our guest in the second hour, Pastor Brent McGuire. And he spent actually quite a bit of time answering that question that came from a caller. Now, the Bible never says Jesus was single or married. It doesn't address the issue. We assume that Jesus is single because it doesn't mention a wife, right? That's a fact. That's true. Now, someone says, why couldn't he have been married? The caller last night said, well, look, marriage isn't a sin. So if it's an issue of Jesus being sinless, then why couldn't he have been married? It's not a sin to marry. And it certainly is not a sin to marry. And what Pastor McGuire said last night, unless you're Jesus. Now, Jesus has a calling not to settle down and put down roots and start a home and put up the picket fence and start you know, living the American dream. That's a general command for each and every one of us to be fruitful and multiply. But Jesus has a different mission. He became a human being not to be a human being. He became man, a human being, in order to redeem humanity. That is his one and only mission. And as Pastor McGuire pointed out, if that's what Jesus' mission from God, is that what he is sent to do in perfect obedience from the Father? For him to settle down, find a wife, have some kids, build a home, is a sin. It was not what he was sent to do. And Jesus makes it clear in the Gospels, he's only there to do what the Father sent him to do and nothing else. So everything you see Jesus doing in the Gospels, he's doing it because his Father sent him to do it. When your mission is to take on human flesh, live a perfect life for sinners, suffer at the hands of sinners, give your life for sinners, and rise again on the third day, I don't think you have time for a wife and kids. But it's not just an issue of time. It's not part of what he was sent to do. Why didn't Jesus marry? There's your answer. He was not sent. He was not sent into human flesh just to be a human being, but to be the sinless sacrifice for our sins. What Pastor McGuire pointed out was, look, it would have also been a sin because he would have knowingly taken a wife that he would have knowingly abandoned. Besides the fact that there is no evidence whatsoever. I think they would have taken note of the fact that he was married if, in fact, he had been married. Back to Dan Brown speaking here, turning to matters religious again.
There was a long silence. Open your minds, my friends. We fear what we do not understand. Like all of us today, the ancients feared what they didn't understand. Earthquakes, tidal waves, eclipses. And they called upon the religion for answers. For the ancients, religion encompassed every aspect of their lives. The movement of the oceans and tides was attributed to the shifting moods of Poseidon. Thunder and lightning was synonymous with the god Thor throwing thunderbolts. The biology of pandemic disease was understood as plagues sent by God. Thousands of years ago, man had a huge pantheon of gods to explain just about everything he didn't understand, from tornadoes to infertility. This kind of religion, in modern scientific terms, is based on an idea called proof from incredulity. In other words, I am incredulous that X could be a natural occurrence. Therefore, X is caused by God.
Now, he's starting to make the case, and I want you to listen very carefully to Dan Brown. High school, English, teacher. Remember those three words. He's starting to make the case, however ham-fistedly, that religion is nothing more than a human invention. Man feels the need for religion because he cannot explain or understand what naturally occurs around him. So man invents God. Now, oddly for Dan Brown, this God is real if you believe in him. And this God may even, in fact, exist if you believe in him, but it is your faith that makes him real, not anything objective. He views religion, Christianity included. This is a huge swipe at every single person who holds to any religious view. He's basically saying, folks, you believe something that was made up by people a long time ago because they didn't understand why it rained or why the sun came up. Now, he's going to make the case that as science explained all those things, the number of gods decreased and we're down to basically one, which he says is the same for all religions. Now, it is altogether true that every other religion in the world besides Christianity is a human contrivance. He's partly right. They are human inventions. The problem here is that he is lumping Christianity together with every other religion, which is very popular to do today. Even some Christians do it. You know, how do we know we've cornered the market on the truth? Maybe these other religions have some truth that we need to learn. Whatever truth there may be in the other religions, is there by mere accident. Man does eventually sometimes stumble upon truths, in spite of the fact that he's headed in the wrong direction.
This is also known as God of the gaps. When there were gaps in mankind's understanding, he would fill them with God. Over time, science began removing those gaps, and the pantheon of God started to shrink. We now understand the science of lightning, and Thor has been banished as a false god, and so on. So in light of this decreasing pantheon of gods, one might expect that our need for God is decreasing. But in fact, if you look at the strength of world religion today, it appears that this is not so. Our need for God has not decreased. It has simply evolved. We no longer turn to God for answers as to why the skies drop hail or why plagues spread. Science has answered those questions. We turn to God for the answers to a handful of questions that science has never been able to answer. Why are we here? What happens when we die? What does all of this mean? And in asking these questions, we realize that we, like the ancients, still worship a God of the gaps.
He's being honest, though. I mean, he is. Although he doesn't know his science very well. If he talked to any real hardcore scientist, they would tell you, yes, we have answered all those questions. Why are we here? Chance. I'm talking about the evolutionary scientists. What happens after you die? You rot and you are no more. What are we doing here? We're just kind of living out a futile existence, you know, like Shakespeare says. Just a person strutting to and fro on the stage, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. That's the answer science, evolutionary science, has given. It's not like those questions haven't been answered by science. Those answers are wrong, but it doesn't keep them from giving the answers. But that's what you, Christian, believe. That's what the Buddhist, the Hindu, the Muslim, the Jew, whatever your religion may be. All religion is essentially the same in Dan Brown's view. Trying to explain the unexplainable or answer the unanswerable, a God of the gaps. That's it. He has, in one fell swoop, with nothing more than a double major in Spanish and English, explained away all human religions, including Christianity.
We still have religion based on proof from incredulity. Many of us cannot believe that all the beauty and order in the universe around us is the result of a random combination of atoms. So therefore, by proof from incredulity, the universe must have been created by some higher power. We simply cannot imagine it any other way. Another example, we are unable to conceive that when we all die, our hopes, dreams, memories, and our very spirits will simply evaporate and disappear. So therefore, there must be an afterlife. We cannot imagine it any other way. These kind of big ideas are the great unifiers of religion. Every one of us in this room, regardless of our particular religious beliefs, or even lack thereof, has had one of those private moments where we stare up at a starlit heaven and we say, wow, whatever that is, it's bigger than my understanding. And in that moment, we see God, whatever that is for each of us. There's a famous thought experiment in which you take 10 deeply religious individuals from 10 different belief systems, and you put them in a field staring up at a starlit sky. And they will all instantly agree, the heavens are awesome, inspiring, and humbling. And in that fleeting instant, all of them will be gazing on the face of the same God.
Now, we got to pause here. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. And if that step is north, you'll end up going north. And if that step is south, you'll end up going south. And if it's west or east, you'll end up going the direction your first step takes you. And he has taken a first step in his argument, and that is, you get people of all religions have them stare up at a starlit sky, and at that moment, they'll all be looking at the same God. And then, as his thought experiment will go on here, we'll hear it, then they start to disagree when they start asking those pesky questions like, who is this God, and how do we please him, and what does he want from us? That's where they start to disagree. But his basic premise that he begins with, that all religions at their core are all addressing the same deity, and then they differ on the details, is absolutely false. The reason religions differ on the details about who God is because we're not all looking at the same God. It's not a popular thought nowadays. Many, perhaps even most Christians, in terms of raw percentage, would probably agree with Dan Brown. But please remember, he's a high school English teacher. He speaks with no more expertise than a double major in Spanish and English. And he happens to have written a novel that sold 60 million copies worldwide and got made into a film. That apparently qualifies him to dismiss, in one fell swoop, all religions and all the disagreements between religions. And he alone, this is so typically boomerish. It really is. He alone sees everything as it really is. He alone is able to stand above it all, look down upon the rest of us, all staring up at the starlit sky, and tell us, oh, you're all looking at the same God, don't you see? All your differences are trivial. He alone is able to see what no one else can see. It's amazing. And all that with nothing more than a double major in Spanish and English. An experience as a high school English teacher. It's audio open lines. When we come back, we'll hear some more from Dan Brown speaking in New Hampshire late last month. I want to hear from you. This break is a great time to call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issues@kfuo.org. We'll be talking about Christianity in Sweden and Finland coming up in about 25 minutes. And we'll spend the third hour of the program answering the question, where we got the New Testament. Pastor Jeffrey Kloa will join us for that. You join us during this break. Give us a call during audio open lines for about another 20 minutes on issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.